Fort Sill, he was to follow them there, and assuming command of all troops there at that point, you will take such measures as will ensure entire control of the Indians there. Mackenzie's troops had scouted for more than a month, fought a few small actions with Comanches, who melted away into the canyon lands, and braved torrents of rain that had begun in September and turned the ground into a glutinous mud. Mackenzie was irritable and, as usual, impatient. Riding long distances took a tremendous toll on his shattered body. He drove the men hard, snapping the stumps of his fingers and railing against the conditions that kept his wagon train mired in knee-deep sludge. At dawn on September 25th, with his wagon stuck in mud, he left them behind and headed northwest. Walking part of the way to preserve the horses, his men marched 20 grueling miles to Tule Canyon, another starkly beautiful formation etched into the edges of the Llano Estacado, cut by Tule Creek, which flowed north to join the Prairie Dog Town Fork of the Red in Palo Duro Canyon. At sunset, one of his scouts rode in with the news Mackenzie had been waiting for. Up ahead, among the many trails leading crazily off in all directions, there was one very big one, made by about 1,500 horses. It led east. Though his men were bone-weary from the long and muddy march, Mackenzie ordered them back in their saddles. They rode on in darkness, a long, dark column moving under a bright harvest moon, through thick buffalo grass that muffled the horses' hooves. They followed the trail for 5 miles, expecting attack at any moment. Mackenzie was aware that his quarry was all around him, silent and elusive as ghosts. When his troops camped for the night, the horses were picketed under a strong guard. The men slept with their boots on and their weapons to hand. Mackenzie stayed in camp the next day, waiting for his supply train to catch up with him. That night, remembering the painful lessons of Blanco Canyon and Shaking Hands Village, and sensing the presence of many Indians, Mackenzie redoubled his precautions. Under his orders, each horse was not only hobbled, meaning that its front legs were tied together, but also cross-sidelined, meaning that forefeet were tied to opposite hind feet. The horses were then secured with 30-foot, 1-inch-thick ropes, which were tied to 15-inch iron stakes driven deep into the ground. In addition, sleeping parties of 12 to 20 men each were posted around the horse herd. Mackenzie was taking no chances. As he had expected, the Indians attacked in force that night. The first charge came at 10:30. Comanches under the command of Shaking Hand, Wild Horse, and Here's the Sunrise galloped through the perimeter of the camp, firing and yelling, trying to stampede the horses. When this did not work, they regrouped and began circling, still hoping to steal the horses. But now they were facing a withering return fire from the horse guards. The Indians withdrew around 1 o'clock. The next morning, Mackenzie's men rode out of camp to find a line of Comanches on high, level ground. Mackenzie attacked. The Indians retreated. Mackenzie lost only 3 horses. The only human casualty happened when a Tonkawa scout named Henry shot the horse out from under an elaborately feathered, in Northern Plains style, Comanche warrior. Henry rode in for the kill, but had forgotten to load his rifle. He was dragged down by his adversary, who began to beat him with his bow. The army troopers, standing nearby and watching, found this amusing. Each time another blow landed on the poor Tonkawa, he pleaded with his friends, "Why you no shoot? Why you no shoot?" Tiring of the joke, one of the soldiers finally shot the Comanche. The Tonk scalped him. The Comanche, of course, knew he was going to die from the moment he lost his horse. While the troopers were snickering, he was fighting his death fight. Such casual cruelty was worthy of a Comanche. It was worth noting that the brave was not carrying a firearm of any kind. Mackenzie now moved to offense. He ordered the mules loaded with 12 days' rations. Once again, he left his supply train, under guard of his infantry and 1 company of cavalry, then marched to the southwest, up Tule Canyon. His enemies were no doubt gratified to see him moving away from their camps. But this was merely a feint executed by a commander who was intimately familiar, as no other white commander was, with the trails through the canyon lands. Mackenzie knew precisely where the Comanche camp was, and was traveling there by the most direct route possible. He had apparently learned of the location of the enemy camp from a captured Comanchero whom Mackenzie had stretched out, presumably painfully, on a wagon wheel. The scouts, riding 25 miles out from the main column, had then verified it. The troopers of the 4th Cavalry held their course until dusk, when the Indians could no longer easily track their movement. Then they turned abruptly north, crossing Tule Canyon in the tracks of Mackenzie's 1872 exploration, and headed out across the muddy plains toward Palo Duro Canyon. He marched the men mercilessly through the night over rough terrain, covering the distance in 12 hours. As the sun was just lighting the eastern sky on September 28th, the 7 companies of the 4th rode up to the abrupt edge of a yawning chasm in the earth. This was Palo Duro, 6 miles wide, just below its junction with a half-mile-wide side canyon known as Blanquecita. The men crept to the edge of the cliff, where the land fell away in a 900-foot vertical drop. They were astonished to see below them, stretching for 3 miles along a stream, 5 distinct Indian villages consisting of 200 lodges and a large herd of horses. The white men were looking into the sanctum sanctorum of Comancheria. Inside this prodigious scar in the earth, caused by 90 million years of erosion, was a world unto itself, a graceful canyon split by a meandering river and greened with juniper, hackberry, wild cherry, mesquite, and cottonwood. At the bottom of the gorge was a stream of crystal clear water that fell from a spring at the canyon's edge. Though the Taibos did not know this at the time, camped there were Comanches under a chief named Ohamatai, the majority of them, Kiowas under Mamanti, and a small group of Cheyennes under Iron Shirt. Mackenzie now took what seemed to at least some of his men to be a huge risk. After wandering for a mile along the canyon rim, he discovered a small, precipitous goat trail leading to the canyon floor and into what one of his men later called the Jaws of Death. Standing at the head of the tiny trail, he turned to his lieutenant and said simply, "Mr. Thompson, take your men down and open the fight." The men dismounted, and stumbling, slipping, and sliding, one by one, they eventually reached the bottom. The risk lay in the exposure of the troops as they came down. It took nearly an hour to get all 7 companies down. They got lucky. Mamanti, the Kiowa chief and medicine man, had consulted the spirits and assured the Indians camped there that they were in no danger of attack from the Bluecoats, so they slumbered without sentries that day. Once again, their medicine had given away an enormous advantage to the whites. Most of the soldiers reached the valley floor before the Indians realized it. As soon as they spotted the soldiers descending the canyon walls, they responded as they usually did when their village was attacked. They fought fiercely in order to cover the escape of their families. Wrote Sergeant John Charlton, "They attacked us from every quarter, first by dozens, later by hundreds. Many were concealed behind rocks, while others were ambushed in the foliage of cedars. The warriors held their ground for a time, fighting desperately to cover the exit of their squaws and pack animals, but under the persistent fire of the troops, they soon began falling back." The troops advanced, with Mackenzie in the lead, through village after village of abandoned Indian lodges. The ground was littered with buffalo robes and dried buffalo meat, but also a wide array of white men's goods, evidence of the deep cultural contamination that had seeped into all corners of plains life. Army blankets, tinner snips, stone china, cooking kettles, breech loaders with ammunition, bales of calico, and sacks of flour. The women had evidently gathered these items up in order to save them, then dropped them as they panicked and fled up the canyon on horseback. What ensued was a 4-mile running fight, during which 4 Comanches were killed. But soon, the troopers were surrounded by Indians again, who now fired down on them from the canyon walls, a circumstance that suggested they had trapped themselves. "How will we ever get out of here?" one frightened trooper asked, afraid the command would be annihilated. Hearing this, McKenzie snapped back, "I brought you in. I will take you out." McKenzie ordered the men forward into the teeth of the attack. His audacity worked. The Indians turned and retreated up the walls of Blanquecita Canyon, following in the path of their families, who had fled earlier. McKenzie did not follow. Instead, he turned back and ordered the villages burned. Bonfires roared. The scent of burning buffalo meat filled the air, along with the smells of scorched Indian Department flour and sugar. Around 3 o'clock, his companies climbed back up the canyon walls, this time with 1,424 captured horses. Once up on the high plains again, the 500 or so men formed a hollow square, a sort of living corral in which the captured herd was driven along. They marched 20 miles, returning to their supply camp in Tule Canyon at 1 a.m. The men, who had been awake and in the saddle for 31 of 33 hours, were exhausted. Sergeant Charlton, who tried to sleep, was awakened by McKenzie's voice, pitched to that high, fretful key, saying, "Wake up, Sergeant! Wake up your men and look after the horses!" After breakfast, McKenzie gave the best of the horses to his scouts, cut out a few for his own use, and then ordered the others, more than 1,000, shot. Custer had shot horses on the Washita in 1868, but that was mere expediency, since his column was in grave danger of annihilation. McKenzie now did it as a military tactic, a way to take away the Indians' means of survival. It was a gruesome job, and it took time. The infantry roped the crazed horses and led them into firing squads. As more and more horses were killed, they became harder to handle. The last one was not shot until almost 3 o'clock in the afternoon. The result was a massive pile of dead horses. They rotted at the head of Tule Canyon, then turned to bleached bones that remained there for many years, becoming both a navigational landmark and a grotesque monument marking the end of the horse tribe's dominion on the plains. Eventually, some enterprising person gathered what was left up and sold it for fertilizer. McKenzie's slaughter of the Comanche horses also spawned a legend. On certain nights, it is said, a phantom herd can be seen galloping through the canyon, riderless, their spectral manes flying in the wind. Thus ended the Battle of Palo Duro Canyon. Only 4 Indians had been killed, but McKenzie had dealt them a devastating blow. No one knows how many of them were camped in the village, but the number of lodges suggests perhaps 1,000. And these Indians now faced a terrible new reality. They were mostly afoot, without shelter, food, or clothing, facing winter on the high plains, where the buffalo herds were being quickly thinned out by the hide men. They had been routed, in large number, from their last important hideout. Most of the Indians who escaped through Blanquecita Canyon that day straggled back to Fort Sill in the following weeks, thoroughly beaten, and never to roam off the reservation again. Sheridan's great campaign was soon over. The hide-and-seek game continued through the winter, with ever fewer Indians as players. A number of Indians had returned to Fort Sill in the fall. Those who had not were short of food. Some were starving to death. In February, Lone Wolf and the last of the Kiowas came in. In March, 825 Southern Cheyennes gave up. Small groups and individuals streamed continuously in. In April, the Comanche bands of Shaking Hand, Here's the Sunrise, and Wild Horse surrendered with 35 warriors, 140 women and children, and 700 horses. They were initially put into concentration camps west of Fort Sill. They were disarmed and had their horses and mules taken from them. Chiefs who had broken treaties or promises were often dealt with harshly. The Kiowa Satanta was sent to a prison in Huntsville, Texas, where he committed suicide by diving headfirst from a second-floor window of the prison hospital. Others were sent by rail to exile in Florida. When the authorities realized how thoroughly broken the horse tribes were, they allowed most of the chiefs to come back. For all of its lack of large-scale drama, Sheridan, in his report for 1875, called the Red River War the most successful of any Indian campaign in this country since its settlement by the whites. By the end of April, there were only a few bands of Southern Plains Indians that had not surrendered, by far the largest of which were Quanah's Quahadis. As far as the army could tell, the band had completely disappeared after the Battle of Adobe Walls. There were 400 of them, including 100 able-bodied fighting men. In spite of their numbers and a large horse herd, they had accomplished the signal feat of completely evading the white man's incessant patrols. They had done this by quick and agile movement. They had also stayed well south of the other concentrations of Indians in the Panhandle, spending most of their time camped southeast of present-day Lubbock, near the towns of Gale and Snyder, just on the eastern side of the Caprock. Mackenzie searched for them twice there, acting on intelligence from captured Kiowas. He had found nothing. He had, in fact, spent a good deal of time looking for Quanah. In his third and last scouting trip in December 1874, he had spent 17 days and traveled 255 miles, all in the southern part of the Llano Estacado. His men had trudged through deep snow and ice storms from today's Floydada to Snyder, during which time they had killed exactly 3 Indians. They did find a fresh trail heading across the high plains to the Muchoque country, a favorite trading site near today's Gale. Mackenzie followed. He was so sure that he had Quanah's band in his sights that he requested that an immediate detachment of troops be sent from Fort Concho to intercept it. Nothing came of that, either. Bogged down in yet another snowstorm, Mackenzie received a message from Sheridan that his war duties were over. He was to report to Fort Sill and assume command of the Comanche Kiowa and Cheyenne Arapaho reservations. In a later interview, Quanah said that he had spent the entire fall and winter playing cat and mouse with the Federals. "Having several hundred good horses," he said, "we kept a good watch for the approach of the enemy, and when we would learn that they were coming in our direction, we would quickly move. Several of my men, with our families, kept up that kind of tactic all winter. During that time, we were almost continuously going, as the soldiers were after us, and many times they were almost upon us. They hunted buffalo when they could, and when they could not eat buffalo or horse meat, they reverted to the old Comanche ways of the pre-horse days in Wyoming, eating nuts, grubs, and rodents. They most likely traded with Comancheros, who had slipped through Mackenzie's blockade. They had a very hard time." On March 16, 1875, Mackenzie arrived at Fort Sill. By mid-April, he was aware that only one large band remained in the wild, and he knew who they were. On April 23, he dispatched a special delegation to try to persuade Quanah to come in peacefully. It consisted of a Dr. Jacob J. Sturm, a self-styled physician and translator who had married a Caddo woman, plus 3 Comanches, including the Quahadi chief, Wild Horse. They had only a vague idea of where they were going. They headed southwest from Fort Sill, crossed the Red River, and traveled along the eastern edge of the Caprock. Near the present town of Matador, they came upon a small 15-lodge village of the Quahadi chief, Blackbeard. The emissaries were received cordially, and Blackbeard readily accepted Mackenzie's offer to come peaceably in with his 50 Comanches. The winter had been brutally hard. He said he was tired of war, and told the white men where Quanah's camp was. It was 2 sleeps distant. On May 1st, Sturm and his group found the camp more or less exactly where Mackenzie had thought it was. Sturm wrote, "On our arrival in camp, the Indians rode up from every direction to see who we were, and finding we were peace messengers, they invited us to alight from our horses, which were taken care of by the squaws, while we were escorted to a large tent by the men. Here we divided our tobacco, coffee, and sugar with them, which pleased them immensely, having had none of the luxuries for a long time." He spent the next 2 days in council with both Quanah and Isatai, who had somehow retained his influence and position in spite of his glaring failure at Adobe Walls. Sturm made an interesting observation about him. "The medicine man says he is no chief, but admits that he has much influence over his people. He further states that he has not acquired this influence by being a warrior, and what influence he has, he acquired by kind treatment of his people, never abusing them. He says he has a big heart, loves everybody and every living thing, that he never gets mad or strikes even a beast. Quanah, unexpectedly, was preaching surrender. He had been foremost among the white man haters. He had burned hottest for revenge for the death of his father, the capture of his mother and sister, and the death of his nephew and other friends and family. He had demonstrated a willful disregard of personal danger at Adobe Walls, and he had spent the early summer killing white people. He had long despised the Comanches who traveled the white man's road. He also understood that he was a half-breed, and that his mother had been a white woman. Now he spoke passionately in favor of taking the white man's road. Parker family legend has it that in order to make his decision, Quanah had gone to a mesa top to meditate. He had begun to pray to the Great Spirit for guidance when he saw a wolf that howled at him and ran off in the direction of Fort Sill. Then he saw an eagle who swooped down at him several times and flew off to the northeast. He took these as signs that he should surrender. His people agreed. Isatai left a pictographic note for 30 men of the band who were out on a buffalo hunt, writing it on buffalo skin and sticking it on a pole, and on May 6, 1875, the entire group left for Fort Sill. They traveled slowly. Their horses, weakened from lack of food and the harsh winter, were unable to do otherwise. The slowness of the travel lent a sort of wistfulness to the journey. There was a sense that they were performing what amounted to the last rites of freedom. The Comanches hunted every day. They killed buffalo and antelope and wild horses and feasted on food cooked in rock-lined pits. They stopped periodically while women dried and packed meat, the men raced horses, and the children chased prairie chickens. They drank the white man's coffee, loaded with sugar. They danced the old dances. Sturm said that they make it to be the last medicine dance that they ever expect to have on these broad plains. They say they will abandon their roving life and try to learn to live as white people do. Strangely, Sturm records no bitterness, no sadness. Perhaps this was simply a failure of imagination. Perhaps the people really had no idea what bean farming or sheep ranching was going to be like, or what it was like to live in a single place, in a single dwelling, and never move with the spring herds, or what Comanche men would find to do with themselves if there was no hunting or fighting, and no way to prove their worth. At noon on June 2nd, nearly a month after they left their camp, 407 Quahatis arrived at Signal Station, a few miles west of Fort Sill, and surrendered themselves, their 1,500 horses, and their arms to the military authorities of the United States. They were treated well. Unlike the other tribes and bands before them, the warriors were not sequestered, under guard, in a roofless ice house with a stone floor, where once a day a wagon stacked with raw meat came by, and soldiers threw chunks of it over the walls. The women, children, and old men, meanwhile, were taken off to their appointed campground. At the time, there were only 50 holdouts remaining. They were all camped on the reservation. From the moment of Quanah's arrival, Colonel McKenzie took an intense interest in him. In spite of his travails with them, McKenzie admired the Quahatis. When he learned they were coming in, he wrote Sheridan, "I think better of this band than any other on the reserve. I shall let them down as easily as I can." He did, in fact. The Quahatis were allowed to keep a large number of their horses, and he made sure that no one in Quanah's band was confined in the ice house or guardhouse at Fort Sill. There are no records of what happened when the two men first met, or what they said to each other. What is known is that before Quanah even arrived, McKenzie had found out via messenger the identity of his mother and had written a letter dated May 19, 1875, to the military quartermaster at Denison, Texas, inquiring about the whereabouts of Cynthia Ann and Prairie Flower. The letter was also published in a Dallas newspaper and managed to elicit the information that both Quanah's sister and his mother were dead. He had not yet met Quanah, but the letter was the beginning of what history records as a remarkable friendship. 20. Forward in defeat. The reservation was a shattering experience. It was bad enough that the Comanches, having bent to the white man's will, had to line meekly up to receive his beneficence. Like small, helpless children, they were now unable to feed or clothe themselves. But, as usual, to layer nightmare upon nightmare, much of this desperately needed welfare never came. The system was both cruel and humiliating. The Taibos had taken away everything that had defined Comanche existence and offered nothing but crude squalor in its place. From the moment the people arrived, there was only a great yawning void of hunger and desperation and dependency. There was no way out and no way back. The white man's charity came in two forms, food rations and annuities. The latter consisted of $30,000 worth of goods each year for the combined Comanche and Kiowa tribes. Divided by 3,000 residents, that meant $10 per person. The goods included axes, frying pans, thimbles, tin plates, butcher knives, and basic clothing. A lot of it was shoddy, if not completely worthless. The Comanches usually sold it cheap to the white men. The beef ration of 1.5 pounds per person per day, on which the Indians mainly survived, turned out to be a bureaucratic and logistical disaster. The beef was issued on the hoof, and the government's assumption was that an animal would produce edible food in the amount of 50% of its weight. This was a fine notion in a wet, fertile season when there was plenty of grass, but in winter, many of the range-fed cattle lost so much weight that many only had value as hides. Since the reservation's game was nearly hunted out, and the buffalo rarely came into range, and the non-beef components of the ration, flour, coffee, sugar, salt, were less than half of what a soldier got, when they came at all, many families went hungry. The weekly issue did at least provide a diversion, if a pathetic one. The ration cows would be released from their pens, and then the Comanche warriors, whooping and yelling, would run them down and kill them with bows, arrows, and pistols. Strange, then, that this despondent, crippled, post-cataclysmic world became the staging ground for the remarkable career of Quanah Parker, as he would insist on being called, the man who became the most successful and influential Native American of the late 19th century, and the first and only man ever to hold the title Principal Chief of the Comanches. His rise was doubly strange, since he had been the hardest of the hard cases, the last holdout of the last band of the fanatical Quahadis, the only band of any tribe in North America that had never signed a treaty with the white man. At the time of his surrender, he was 27 years old. He was known as a fierce and charismatic warrior, a true killer, probably the toughest of his generation of Comanches, which was saying something. He had killed many Indians and white people in his short life, a statistic that will remain forever unknown, because in the reservation years he quite intelligently refused to address the subject. He had led his own band in the wilderness after his elopement with Wakia, and was famous for having done so. Along with Isatai, he was the most prominent and fastest rising of the young war chiefs. His surrender to Mackenzie in June 1875 ended such traditional career prospects forever. But it also marked the beginning of something. His attitude toward his captivity had completely changed by the time he arrived at Fort Sill. He would take the white man's road. He would leave the glories of the free life on the plains behind, and he would not look back. Just as important, he would strive to lead his often recalcitrant, retrogressive tribe down that road. That meant the white man's farming and ranching, white man's schools for the children, white man's commerce and politics and language. The void that loomed before the pitiable remnant of the Comanches was, for Quanah Parker, a grand opportunity. He would remake himself as a prosperous, tax-paying citizen of the United States of America who dressed in wool suits and Stetson hats and attended school board meetings. And he would try to haul the rest of the Comanche nation along with him. In the dreary, hopeless winter of 1875-76, the notion of bourgeois citizen Comanches was just short of ridiculous. No one would have wanted it anyway. But Quanah saw the future clearly. On the high and wild plains, he had been a fighter of jaw-dropping aggressiveness. Now, he would move just as resolutely from the life of a late Stone Age barbarian into the mainstream of industrial American culture. Quanah arrived on the harsh shores of the American nation, like many other immigrants, in abject poverty. When he reached Fort Sill, he had two wives, a daughter, a degree of standing in the tribe, and little more. He was a ration drawer like everyone else, living in a teepee near the agency, waiting patiently in long lines for food. Whatever wealth he had possessed in the way of horseflesh was gone. Killing or dispersing Comanche horse herds was an integral part of the whites' economic and military destruction of the Comanche tribe. In both white and Comanche terms, he was destitute. Quanah was, moreover, only one of a number of chiefs with a claim on band or tribal leadership. There were older leaders like Horseback, Nokoni, Milky Way, Panataka, Shaking Hand, Kotsotika, Wild Horse, Quahadi, and most especially Here's the Sunrise, Yamparika, all of whom wielded more influence than he did. But he was undeterred. From his first days on the reservation, he plotted to advance himself and was not shy about it. Perhaps he had discovered something about his true nature in the days when he and Isatai had recruited Indians from five tribes to attack the buffalo hunters, a feat unprecedented in Plains history and one that caused him to be deferred to even by such great chiefs as the Kiowa's Lone Wolf. Up until that disastrous first morning at Adobe Walls, when Isatai's magic failed and the buffalo guns roared, they had been stunningly successful. Quanah understood that the way to power was through the white man and his power to designate and appoint leaders, as it was for the native populations in 19th-century British colonies in Malaysia, India, and elsewhere. Thus, he cultivated both the Indian agent, the Quaker M. Hayworth, and the army commander, who from April 1, 1875 until 1877 was the irascible and brutally competent Ranald Slidell Mackenzie. Mackenzie had been surprised to learn of his parentage and had taken some trouble, starting with his May 19th letter, to find out what had happened to his mother and sister. In one of their early meetings, Mackenzie told Quanah what he had learned, thus shattering Quanah's immemorial dreams of a reunion with his beloved mother. Still, Quanah had a fierce curiosity about his white family and continued to write, which meant having someone else write letters, seeking information. Throughout the reservation years, Quanah's apparent level of literacy varied with the educational level of whoever he got to write for him. He sounds alternately like a hillbilly, a pidgin-speaking Indian, and an English professor. Evidence of his blossoming relationship with his new friend Mackenzie was a letter Mackenzie wrote on Quanah's behalf to Cynthia Ann's 82-year-old uncle, Isaac Parker, in Fort Worth. In it, he explained to Isaac that Quanah was upset that the Parkers were apparently refusing to acknowledge him as a member of their family, and argued that Quanah certainly should not be held responsible for the sins of a former generation of Comanches, and is a man whom it is worth trying to do something with. Isaac never replied. The two men met on many other occasions. They lived for a while in close proximity to each other, Quanah in his teepee and Mackenzie in the row of houses that constituted the Fort Sill officers' quarters. Quanah later told Charles Goodnight, after Goodnight complimented him on his manners, that it had been Mackenzie who had taken the time to teach him about white ways. This suggested that the two men had spent significant time together. It would have been something to watch the etiquette lessons given by America's greatest Indian fighter to the man who would turn out to be the last Comanche chief. In a world of sullen, dispossessed Indians, camped disconsolately in teepees in the grassy, rolling hills and stream bottoms around Fort Sill, Quanah made a point of being cheerful, helpful, and cooperative. That was his nature anyway. He was naturally gregarious, the product of an intensely communal society where consensus building was the most valued political skill and the particular skill that he possessed in abundance. A young war chief's standing was based entirely on his ability to recruit warriors to go along with him on raids and military expeditions. recruitment, and consensus was what the Adobe Walls campaign was all about. Quanah volunteered to bring back several Comanches who had left the reservation to hunt buffalo. He also brought in a brave who was charged with murdering a soldier. His approach soon paid off. When Agent Hayworth divided up the tribes into beef bands in order to streamline the rationing process, he appointed leaders of each band, and by 1878, Quanah had been named head of the third largest band. Thus, like a ward boss in Chicago of a later day, he controlled the distribution of goods, and obviously guaranteed his own take. This was his first taste of power in the new political order, and it did not come without consequences. Some of the Comanche leaders despised him and his favored status with the Taibos. They would force him to fight for whatever power he got for virtually his whole life on the reservation. Just as important for the new politics of captivity, Quanah agreed to go on a special mission for his new friend Mackenzie. His task? To track down and bring back a small group of renegade Comanches and their families who remained outside the reservation. In July 1877, Quanah set out to find them with two older Comanche men, three women, and several government pack mules loaded with supplies. He carried a white flag and a stern letter from Colonel Mackenzie on Army letterhead detailing Quanah's mission and promising severe consequences for anyone who interfered with it. Still, it was an extremely dangerous undertaking. The land to the west of Fort Sill was loaded with buffalo hunters and other cold-eyed men in the hide business who sought revenge on Indians in general and specifically on Comanches. A lightly armed party of six, consisting mostly of old men and women, would have been easy prey. That Quanah, until his surrender, one of the most arrogant warriors of the plains, and at the height of his physical prowess, would undertake such a bloodless diplomatic mission with women as his outriders, was extraordinary. It showed just how much he had changed his thinking, or perhaps it showed how much he wanted to impress his new bosses.
This is the end of the CD. The audiobook continues on the next CD.